You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
Later on, we're going to be talking about Cassini, the mission to Saturn that's been there for over a decade and comes to an end with a grand finale this year. But first of all, let's look much further out into space at some renegades. And specifically, these are renegade black holes. Not just your common black hole that's formed from the death of a massive star that is pretty massive, the mass of the sun or more. These are supermassive black holes.
I think that's an entirely unoriginal way of describing them, but that's really what common parlance is that you use supermassive black hole to describe the black hole at the centre of a galaxy. So this is something which is... it's impossible for it to have been formed from a star death. And actually, the process of which they were formed is actually quite unclear, whether they were primordial or whether they're the accumulation of lots of black holes over a long period of time. It's quite unclear.
Yeah. And to give a sense of scale, when we say supermassive, these are millions of times the mass of our sun.
Yes,
they
right.
really are huge. And then in terms of size, they're like the size of the solar system,
yeah.
One object in terms of
the... And they sit at the centre of spiral galaxies and basically make sure that spiral galaxies spin. That's where, you know, a massive thing at the centre is like the hub in your bicycle wheel.
Yeah, and it controls, certainly has a big impact on the stars right in the centre of the galaxy. In fact, we know that there's a supermassive black hole, a couple of million times the mass of our sun, at the centre of our own galaxy. Not dangerous, 28,000 light years away or thereabouts.
Yeah.
So it's not going to do us any harm. But as you say, there's one at the centre of every large galaxy. And when we say centre, they do seem to sit there. Right at the centre. There's been one found, this renegade one, because it's not quite at the centre.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, it seems to be that this is pointing to a galaxy that has collided with another galaxy at some point in its past, and that's what's dragged it away from the centre. And you see this sort of recoil effect. So a little bit like if you've got two enormous... balls made of something very, very heavy, and you hit them together. It's very difficult to move them, but you can actually produce a little bit of movement if you have something to disturb it.
And in fact, there's a possibility that this black hole is not just not quite in the centre, but is moving out of the centre. It's been flung out from this merge of these two galaxies, both of which would have had a supermassive black hole.
Yeah, that's right.
And you can throw things out, particularly if you end up with these two black holes merging. They will produce gravitational waves. We
have
the LIGO detector detecting gravitational waves from black holes a couple of years ago. So when these merge and they produce gravitational waves, if those gravitational waves don't go out the same amount in every direction, then it can actually give them a kick and make them fly off in one direction or another. That's one of the theories as to what might have happened here.
Yeah. It's actually very, very simple dynamics in a way, even though it involves general relativity.
Yeah, black holes are beautifully simple in their description because they just have a mass and a spin and maybe an electric charge and nothing else, no other properties. So it's called the no-hair theorem, which is always quite nice. But that's a digression. These renegade black holes, or this renegade black hole, possibly giving a hint as to what might happen in some of these mergers of black holes, if that indeed is what happened, and the kind of merger that might be visible or might be observable with future space-based gravitational wave detectors in a couple of decades' time. So I might not hold my breath.
Yeah.
So bringing us closer to home, we can come well within our solar system, so from millions of light years away to billions of kilometres away. A new object been found by the ALMA Observatory.
Or rather, hasn't it? So a new object was observed by ALMA, but it was actually found by a 4-meter telescope called the Blanco Telescope in Chile, the Chilean Inter-American Observatory (CTIO), and ALMA, this multi-dish radio infrared observatory that is sort of configurable in the Atacama Desert, has had a look at it and has been able to resolve it, and that means that we can learn something about its size and more about where it is and more about it. So DD is what it's named. It's been named, and I think this is an unofficial classification. DD is written D-double-E-D-double-E, which sounds like quite a cute name, but it actually stands for Distant Dwarf, because if it does have the characteristics that it's been observed to have, then that places it within the dwarf planet part of the way that we categorise things in the solar system. So it would join, I think, only five other objects in this dwarf planet category, the first of which, notably, is Pluto. Pluto and Ceres, Makemake, Haumea and Eris, I think, are the other ones. So this would become the sixth of that ever-growing family of objects. Its orbit is a different shape to the most of the other dwarf planets. It's highly elliptical, so that means that it's sort of egg-shaped, and it's at present very far away from the sun. It's about 100 times further away from the sun than the Earth is.
That's about 30 times further away than Neptune and Pluto are, so it's a long way
out. Yeah, much further away than those objects. And actually, because it has this strange elliptical orbit, It will come in to about as far away as Pluto is, but it'll go much further out. And it takes about 1,000 years to do that lap around the solar system. It's about 2/3 of the size of Ceres, which is a dwarf planet that's in the asteroid belt. It was actually discovered well before Pluto was discovered, and it was discovered in 1801, and Pluto was discovered in the 1920s. It's very cold. And that's basically all that we know about it at the moment.
Yeah, it's about, I think, 30 degrees above absolute zero, which is minus 240 degrees C.
So, yeah, a pretty cold place. Yeah, and that's really the temperature that cosmic dust is. So it really is, you know, an absolutely freezing place, much colder than the surface of Pluto is.
So it's discovering objects like this is very important for understanding how the solar system has formed, because we need a better build-up of knowledge of these very or much smaller objects in the solar system that have been scattered maybe by the way the planets have moved around over billions of years. And so these kind of discoveries will help that. And it was almost discovered by accident.
Yeah, that's right. It was being looked for. This Blanco telescope is part of the Dark Energy Survey. That is not looking for solar system objects. It's looking for looking at things much further away, and basically comes from the fact that they stare at the sky, looking for supernovae.
But we're building up that catalogue of objects out there, and it's a catalogue of large objects. So maybe there are other large objects that aren't yet classed as dwarf planets. They are just known to be quite big, and we need to. Establish more firmly their sizes and so on, but ALMA is certainly useful in doing that. So maybe that list of five dwarf planets, as you say, will grow in coming years. Now, those planets, those dwarf planets, objects way out in the solar system are much, much too far away for us to go to easily. We have the New Horizons mission visiting Pluto, and then has visited Pluto and will visit another planet, another object out there in a few years. But we can go to closer places a bit more easily, and one place we might want to go to, not with people, but with robotic spacecraft, is the Moon, of course. The Moon is very close, it's very easy to get to, relatively speaking. So there's a large number of potential things we could do, and the European Space Agency, ESA, have run a competition to say, if you could go to the Moon, what would you do?
Yeah, I think that's a really nice competition as well. The Moon is such a beautiful object that everybody is so familiar with, far much more than Mars, actually, because no matter where you are, no matter how bad your light pollution is, you can always see the Moon. And I think that's something that a lot of people cling to. And in the 1960s with the space race, I think that was why the Moon was such an attractive goal to send people there. And I think it's very sad that we haven't sent a person to the Moon since the 70s. And I'm very pleased to see other missions starting to go back to the Moon, because there is still a great deal to do there. So this competition wasn't to send people there. It was to send very small spaceships there. These things called CubeSats, or conglomerations of CubeSats. Yeah. So a CubeSat is a satellite that's about 10 centimetres across. CubeSats is now a term used for CubeSats that are bunched together or something the same size as many of these CubeSats. So actually some of the winners of these are 6 or 12 of them lashed together. I say lashed together. It's probably
string.
Yeah, but that's right. Or sticky back plastic. Yeah. Some of them are to take detailed pictures of the moon. So basically doing what CubeSats do around the Earth, but around the moon. Earth observation, but lunar observation. Some of them are going to be looking at out into space from the dark side of the moon, or the side that we don't see. It's not always dark. Some of them are to do detailed studies of the surface of the moon.
Yeah, and these are looking towards ideas of, you know, one day if we do send people back to the moon and we want people to live there, there's one idea that you say looking at the surface of the moon to see whether what the environment does to the surface, to see whether how complex a building, a shelter we'd have to build for people, I guess, and whether microorganisms would survive out on the surface of the moon in that radiation environment. And I particularly like the one that's looking at taking a radio telescope to the far side of the moon.
Yes.
The problem with radio telescopes is that radio waves are used by people on Earth for all sorts of things. Mobile phones, Wi-Fi, all use radio waves. And it's clogging up, and of course the radio, FM radio, clogging up the spectrum of radio waves that we want to look at out into space. But if you go around the far side of the moon, there's no radio waves from Earth that can get there. So
you're
in a complete radio quiet zone.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing idea because it's such an obvious thing to do because you've got all of the moon shielding you from radio waves. I think CubeSats are a great way of doing it as well because they're very cheap, relatively cheap, to launch. Mm. Instead of being millions to launch these things, they're in the hundreds of thousands of pick your currency.
Yeah.
Well, pick your either dollars, pounds or euros. Don't pick yen or anything.
Yeah. so that's an exciting. This is a short list of plans that are going to be looked at over the coming sort of decade or so. So these studies for these things take a long time to follow through. There are other missions you mentioned at the start, missions going back to the moon. Of course, we have SpaceX have said they want to send people to the moon in the next year or two, a couple of years, or at least around the moon. A good chance that China may well send astronauts, taikonauts, to the moon as well. So lots of stuff probably going to start going on the moon.
Yeah, I think that's really great.
So coming even closer to Earth, one of the challenges with sending people to the moon is getting through all the radiation that's out in space. And there's one particular region around the Earth that has very intense radiation there. It's called the Van Allen Belts. It's this belt of radiation which is there because of the way the Earth's magnetic field and the Sun's magnetic field interact. And it sort of focuses the radiation to one particular region. And it means it's dangerous for satellites because radiation can corrupt satellites' computers. It's dangerous for people because going through radiation fields of high-energy radiation at least can be dangerous or is dangerous. But there's a study that said that these Van Allen belts are changing over time because of what we're doing.
Yeah, that's actually quite a... It's the largest scale effect that that is artificial. So because we have a lot of very low frequency, so not VHF, but VLF radiation coming from the Earth, this has had an effect on the shape, or rather the place in space around the Earth that the Van Allen belts are. It's pushed them further away from the Earth than they were in the 60s when they were looked at. Well, it's good to know that because they're a dangerous place. You don't want to put things there. But it's also a little bit worrying that we're having such a large-scale effect on things in space.
But there is one thing, which is that if radiation fields are dangerous, there's a possibility that you could maybe try and create these bubbles to clear a bit of radiation away by sending VLF transmissions in the future. So you could sort of create a deflector field ahead of you to fly through.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
all this kind of stuff. Probably a lot of radiation to do that. So we have to be quite focused.
But, but VLF is quite low energy, so it might not take very much to do that.
And you could also protect satellites from radiation as well, not just futuristic starships and so on.
That's right. Yeah, force shields.
Yes. So there's some futuristic prospects for doing that as well, which is always good fun. But yeah, interesting study of, as you say, our largest scale effect we've ever had. Now, the story I wanted to focus on this month was the Cassini mission. The Cassini mission is a probe that launched in 1997, so that's 20 years ago, on its way to Saturn. The mission is running out of fuel. The spacecraft has to fire its thrusters now and again to adjust its orbit. And the mission operators, the mission scientists, have decided that instead of risking it crashing onto an alien moon and... or a Saturnian moon, and possibly contaminating it with Earth bacteria, they will crash it into Saturn in September 2017. So that's a few months' time. So this mission that's been there for over a decade is coming to a close. It's been an amazing mission to follow. The images we've had from Cassini and the discoveries we've had have been truly astounding.
Yeah, Cassini's a really great mission. I remember the TV broadcast that went out in 2005 when, when it got to its destination, it was Cassini-Huygens. Mm. Our friend Lucy Green was the presenter in the BBC. And I think it was Adam Hart-Davis as well, who seems to have vanished from the limelight. But it was incredibly exciting to see. And it's... everybody loves a space mission. It really does feel like that over the last 12 years that it has achieved so much. And in fact, it's had a lifetime about three times longer than it was intended to. I think it was supposed to have a four-year lifespan. And because of the high-quality engineering, it didn't take as much fuel as it was anticipated. So it's had an extra 8 years' worth of life. Mm. And it's discovered some amazing things. Some of the things that it's discovered, like the possibility of Enceladus being habitable, this frozen ice world that has jets creeping out through gaps in the ice layer that have hydrogen in them, and that shows that there's some sort of geothermal process that is enriching these vents with hydrogen that has all the good sort of minerals. It means that there's warmth, there's water, and there's good minerals for the production of, or the sustainment of life. Whether it can actually start life there or not, who knows?
But the environment they're talking about at the bottom of this moon is pretty tiny. This moon is only about the size of the UK in terms of its area, if you like, if it's cross section. But this ocean beneath its surface is thought to have, based on, say, these latest results, environments like the deep sea hydrothermal vents, the back smokers
or the white smokers.
Which on Earth are very rich in life.
Yeah, that's right. That was a discovery that was it's 40 years old, actually, 1977, the Galapagos black smokers.
It's also looked a lot at Titan, of course, the largest moon of Saturn, the only other object in the solar system, or the only other rocky object in the solar system besides Earth and Venus to have a large atmosphere, or thick atmosphere, and the only other object besides Earth to have standing liquid on its surface. It has lakes, just not of water, of hydrocarbons, of ethane and methane. Yeah. And the fact that we've seen on Titan a hydrocarbon cycle, it has hydrocarbon rain, it has hydrocarbon rivers, it has hydrocarbon lakes and oceans, and then that evaporates to form hydrocarbon clouds in the atmosphere. The images and what we know now about Titan, there's even been tides shown to be moving in some of the lakes. Ontario Lacus, I think, was one. There's a video of being able to do a full sweep around that, which is astonishing. So the moons of Saturn have been really amazing in what Cassini has shown us.
But it's not only the moons, because Cassini's been studying Saturn itself, and it's discovered a very far out extra ring of Saturn. It's taken close up views of the inner ring structure as well. So areas where they look like they're gaps in Saturn's rings actually aren't gaps. There are rings there. They just have different properties, so they look dark. Because if you look at them they look dark in the type of light that we see with our eyes. But if you look at in infrared light, they're actually glowing a lot more than the other rings are.
It's a different size particle or different type of particle in
that's
in
right, and a different density of particle as well.
And they're also, we know those rings now, are the gaps in the rings and the structure of the rings is defined by the what's called Shepherd moons.
Yeah.
Sometimes the large moons, sometimes these tiny ones that may be a few kilometres across, just causing either orbiting in these gaps or their gravitational influences making these gaps happen.
Yeah, so they're not perfectly flat. Yeah. They have these little asymmetric wiggles in them. It's beautiful.
And the grand finale of Cassini is... To crash into Saturn, but to do so, it's got to get close to Saturn. It spent most of its time orbiting outside all of its time so far orbiting outside the rings, and to crash into Saturn, it's got to go inside the rings. So it's already done one pass, maybe more than one actually, of through between the planet and the rings.
Hmm.
So that's a gap that's only 1,500 kilometers wide or something. It's pretty small. And it's got to pass through that and hope there's nothing there, no little particles. It's going to do that about 20 times and then gradually spiral inwards. But the images we will get from inside the rings, from within the ring gap, the ones we've seen so far, the raw images that have been coming out are astounding, the close-up views we've had.
Yeah, and you're totally right that it's got to be really careful as it comes in because there is... You know, the rings are not solid, they're made of small particles, but small particles, if you think that they're going to be quite soft, but actually they're not, they're going to be hard, frozen, and if Cassini passes through a ring, it's going to virtually destroy it, it's going to be pebble dashed to death. So it has to be really careful that that it stays far enough away from the rings that there aren't any bits of ring material that are too small to be seen, but big enough to do significant damage.
I know it travels at something like 70,000 miles an hour or kilometres an hour. It doesn't really matter at that speed.
Yeah.
Very, very fast through the ring. So that's why those tiny particles are so dangerous. But it also rotates. So it has a large, called a high-gain antenna. It's basically this big radio dish that lets it communicate to Earth. It flies with that out front. So that if it does hit anything, that dish gets hit and not the rest of the spacecraft, because that can, you know, if you get a couple of holes in that, it'll be okay.
Yeah, that's right, because it's a radio dish. Yeah. It can be perforated quite substantially and you'd still be able to send signals back.
Cassini has clearly been a huge success, and I thought it'd be interesting to speak to someone much closer to the mission. Someone is Dr. Lee Fletcher from the University of Leicester, who's heavily involved with Cassini and researches the atmospheres of gas giant planets. I began by asking Lee why we sent Cassini to Saturn in the first place.
So what you need to remember is that back in the late 80s and early 90s, when Cassini was first being formulated, we'd only had a couple of spacecraft, or three spacecraft rather, ever fly past Saturn. And the discoveries that the Pioneer missions in the late 70s and the Voyager missions in the early 80s made at Saturn were really tantalizing. An incredible structure in the rings, this enigmatic shrouded moon in Titan, which is one of the largest moons in the solar system, and then the beautiful patterns we were seeing in the atmosphere of Saturn itself. And we always knew that we wanted to go back to this system simply because it was so rich. It would keep so many planetary science communities fascinated for so long, those who are interested in atmospheres like myself, those who are interested in the small icy satellites, those who wanted to explore this Earth-like moon in Titan, and those that wanted to look at the processes within the larger systems, such as the rings and the large magnetic field. So Saturn, you know, as well as being a beautiful destination in its own right, was just going to tick so many boxes for so many members of the community that it was such a no-brainer. That was the destination that in the 90s we really wanted to be going for. So, of course, 1997, after many years of struggles, this mission launched into the night sky from Cape Canaveral and headed off on a seven-year journey out to the ringed planet, and finally arrived in 2004. And even then, Cassini was only expected to last for just 4 years. That's what all the instruments and the spacecraft were designed to accomplish in the terms of mission design. That was our requirement. We had to meet that requirement of surviving for 4 years. But the engineering on the spacecraft was so precise, so accurate, and so careful that it meant that we have now had an asset there in the Saturn system, not for 4 years, but for 13 years. And the only thing that's limiting the lifetime of this incredible spacecraft is the amount of fuel that's on board. The reason that we're ending this mission today in 2017 is that the fuel is running out. And we actually don't know exactly how much is left on board. It could be a lot, it could be a little, but they're eking every last morsel of science out of this, the last stages of this mission. And so all of those science goals of exploring the atmosphere, the ring system, the moons, have really been accomplished over the course of this mission.
Well, as you say, it's succeeded in almost all its science goals. You're personally interested in the atmospheres of gas giant planets. What do we now know about the atmosphere of Saturn? Because from the Earth, to be honest, through a telescope, it looks a bit beige.
A bit beige, yellow and ochre in sort of appearance. That's absolutely right. And I think the thing that, from my personal perspective, is fascinating about Saturn is that it has an axial tilt, much like the Earth. So it's tilted by about 27 degrees. And that means on its slow orbit around the Sun, it subjects different areas of the atmosphere to different levels of sunlight. It has seasons, spring, summer, autumn, and winter, just like we do on Earth. But those seasons last for many Earth years. It takes Saturn 30 Earth years to go around the Sun. And so if you really want to understand how a gas giant planet responds to these changes in sunlight, you have to be there for a long time. It's no good having a mission that will only last for 1 or 2 years, say. And that's why Cassini has been so important. So what it's been able to do from 2004, at which point Saturn's south pole was sort of illuminated by the Sun, it was near summertime conditions in the south, we've tracked it all the way through to today, and in fact at the time of recording, today is the northern summer solstice on Saturn. So that means that we actually have the North Pole in view, implying that we've tracked it over half of a Saturnian year and experienced all those seasons. And what we've seen are changes in the thermal structure, changes in the chemical structure, changes in the cloud opacity. You mentioned a second ago that Saturn has this yellow appearance as viewed from Earth. But when you get up to the more wintry latitudes, those latitudes that we cannot see from our Earth-based positions, Saturn's atmosphere actually appeared blue. And this was really exciting. The blue colours were more akin to what you're familiar with when you look at Uranus and Neptune compared to those yellow colours of Saturn. And it's an aerosol effect. As winter gives way to spring, haze particles can grow and can increase in their size. And as they become larger, they start to scatter more light. And those blue colours we've seen then replaced by the more familiar yellow colours over the course of time. So that's an example of a very slow seasonal change on Saturn. But there's other more spectacular changes that can occur. And back in 2011, shortly after the beginning of spring in Saturn's northern hemisphere, we saw the eruption of an enormous cloud system in the northern hemisphere of Saturn, accompanied by super powerful lightning strikes that could be heard by Cassini's radio wave detectors as it was orbiting around the planet. And that powerful storm system dredged up material, dredged up ices and gases from deep within the planet up to the levels that we could then detect it and watch how the prevailing winds on the planet then redistributed that material around. It was really an exciting time for Cassini scientists like myself and for Earth-based observers to watch as an enormous springtime storm system, April showers if you like, evolved in the atmosphere of another planet. And it lasted for months. It lasted for months and has still had producing after effects on the planet even today, sort of 6 or 7 years on. Now, the last thing I want to say about Saturn's atmosphere is what's going on at the poles, because the poles are really hard for us to do from the ground. You never get a very clear view.
And that's just because it's tilted, so we can't quite see the poles.
So we can see some of it from that tilt, but for example, we only ever see one pole at a time. You're never going to see both at the same time. And for the North Pole, for example, by the time that Cassini arrived, had been in darkness for something like 10 years, meaning that it was shrouded in this darkness of polar winter. And when Cassini got there, every now and then it ramps up its orbit. So from being orbiting around the equatorial plane, in the same plane as the rings, sometimes it will increase its inclination so that it's actually zipping over higher latitudes rather than being in the equatorial plane itself. That means you get a brilliant vantage point to look down at the poles. And what we discovered there were these enormous churning cyclones locked at both poles. And I always like to describe this as a sort of plug hole, with the air sinking down into the center of the cyclone and taking with it cloud material and gaseous abundances. So the eyes of those cyclones, rather like a hurricane on Earth, seem depleted and very clear. You can see right down into the depths of Saturn by staring into the eyes of those polar cyclones. And that was something that we'd not seen before and was very exciting to observe from Cassini for the first time. In fact, you know, to put a personal note on it, my PhD thesis back in the mid-2000s was looking at the dynamics and the chemistry of those polar cyclones. And it was amazing to be witnessing something for the first time using data from this robotic spacecraft. It was a really exciting time for me.
And the images of these are truly amazing. And with Cassini now in its polar orbits, the images, which you can find on the NASA website, on the ESA website for Cassini, those images are absolutely staggering, just gorgeous.
They certainly are, and we're much, much closer than we've ever been before. You know, this end game of the mission, when we're actually zipping around Saturn once every 6 or 7 days or so, is sampling an environment that no spacecraft has ever been into before. We're closer to the planet, we're within the rings themselves, so we're zipping through a gap in the rings. And actually on the later orbits in the coming months, we'll be dipping so low down that we'll actually be able to sample Saturn's upper atmosphere, which again has never been done before. And I should say, Cassini was never designed to do. Okay, we never expected to get this incredible extension to the mission, which allows us to almost turn it into a brand new mission with science goals and science targets that were never envisaged back when Cassini was first formulated, now a couple of decades ago. So we'll be sampling the atmosphere. We'll be trying to directly measure what Saturn's atmosphere is made of. We know it's bulk of hydrogen and helium with a lot of trace species like methane and ammonia and various others. But we don't know the precise proportions. When you look at it remotely, there's always an ambiguity or an uncertainty in exactly what gases are there present within the atmosphere. Well, Cassini, in its dying moments, will be trying to solve that particular conundrum by taking direct samples. So it's going to be extremely sad for all of those who have worked on the mission to see this grand old spacecraft finally be destroyed in the atmosphere of Saturn. But I think, you know, we can be very proud of what this mission has accomplished. You know, it has achieved its science goals, as we said at the beginning, but much more than that, it's discovered things that we simply didn't expect. I'll give you an example. The gases that are erupting from the south pole of Enceladus, spewing watery material out into Saturn's environment to create one of the thin, tenuous rings that we see orbiting around Saturn. And then there's Titan. I mean, we haven't really discussed Titan, but that has been revealed as a very an Earth-like world, if you like, with active meteorological cycles, with networks of mountains and valleys, and those valleys funnel the liquids down onto dune plains, and you see dune fields. And then high up at the poles of Titan, you see these extremely large lakes and seas. I mean, space exploration has often been liked to those early explorers who went across the oceans in sailing ships to find new land and new peoples. And for the first time in the history of space exploration, we can now actually imagine sailing some vessel on an extraterrestrial sea, which I think, you know, if you're not a scientist, that still fires the imagination of what it must be like to be sat there sort of bobbing along on these waves on Titan, looking back at the shoreline and the mountains in the distance, and maybe being able to see some hint of Saturn illuminated in the sky. It's an environment that in the last 13 years has been revealed to those of us on Earth for the first time. And I think that's the true sort of heritage of this mission, that it's taught us about places and given us surprises that nobody expected to see when this mission first launched.
Now, Cassini's final death throes are going to involve plunging into the atmosphere of Saturn. How much of that data are we going to get back from this final phase of its mission?
Well, that's a really good question. So, as I said, there's going to be five final orbits that are going to go and sample low down in Saturn's atmosphere. So that data will be collected from an instrument called the INMS. It's a mass spectrometer that will measure the gaseous composition and should be able to send that data back to Earth. At some point during those final sequences, the camera will be used to create a final mosaic of Saturn, a lovely image to say goodbye with, if you like, and that will be the final imaging data set that is acquired. Now, on that very last plunge, we will continue to take data with various instruments, including the instrument that I've been part of for the last 13 years, which is an infrared device. And what we're hoping is that as Cassini starts to enter the atmosphere of Saturn, its high-gain antenna, which is a 3.5-meter dish on top of the spacecraft, can maintain lock on planet Earth. And that's crucial, because as soon as we lose lock, i.e. it starts to veer off from the direction of Earth, we will lose the signal, and that will be the end of the mission from our perspective. Now, I attended a meeting about 12 months ago that was discussing the final fate of Cassini, and the head of my particular instrument said a pretty profound thing. He said, the sad thing about Cassini is that we're going to tumble before we burn, and that means that the spacecraft antenna will start to move off of planet Earth and will start to tumble as the spacecraft spins, because you've got all these devices that are starting to experience torques on the spacecraft, causing it to start to spin uncontrollably before it then burns up in the atmosphere in those final moments. So we will get some data. Of course, we're hoping to get as much as we possibly can, but it's very hard for us to predict exactly how the spacecraft is going to tumble in those last few minutes.
So we know what's going to happen in September this year with the end of the Cassini mission, but what about the further future? You've mentioned that we've made all these tantalising discoveries about Cassini, but to really know about them, to really find out more, we need to be there for long periods of time to know more about the composition of Saturn's atmospheres, to know more about the structure of the rings, to find out more about the fountains of Enceladus, the geysers of Enceladus, and what they're all about. And also, possibly even, as you said, to sail on the seas of Titan. How long are we going to have to wait for any of those kinds of missions?
Well, another mission to return to the Saturn system, I would estimate, is not likely before the end of the 2020s. So you're talking, at least 10 to 15 years in the future before we were to get not just back to the system, but even a spacecraft launched. And the issue is that these mission concepts are so few and far between that you have to invest a lot of time and energy in ensuring that mission will work correctly when it's launched, because you don't get second chances in this business. If you fail on one launch, it could then be decades before you get a chance to do it again. Now, there's no shortage of good ideas, okay? There are ideas to send entry probes into Saturn's atmosphere, to descend under parachute and to measure directly the properties of the atmosphere down to great depths. Not like Cassini, which will burn up high in the atmosphere, but a probe that actually goes deep into the clouds to see what's churning below those cloud decks. There are ideas to land probes and boats and even gliders within the atmosphere of Titan, some sort of aerial platform that would be able to circumnavigate Titan's globe and explore the planet in situ, which would be really exciting. There's ideas to fly through the plumes of Enceladus or fly through the rings and to scoop up material and potentially cache it to later bring it back to planet Earth. And of course, that would be a very exciting and long-term mission. So all of these ideas are out there. I would say that the technology is also there to accomplish these things. But there's an element of competition, both within the European Space Agency and in the US Space Agency, that means that all of these ideas are competing with all the other exciting destinations in the solar system that we would like to go to. And in my personal idea is that we should be going to the ice giants Uranus and Neptune next, and imagine what we might discover if we had a mission as capable as Cassini out there in orbit around Uranus or Neptune. I think that would be a fantastic discovery space that it would open up. Now, that's not to sound glum. Of course, there's the missions I hope will happen at some point within our lifetimes, but before then we have a whole fleet of new Earth-based telescopes coming online. For example, the James Webb Space Telescope will be launching next year, and out in Chile and out in the United States, they're developing telescopes that are enormous in size, 30 meters or so across, which will be able to see the giant planets of our solar system, and Saturn, Titan, and the rings are included in that list, and be able to give us new insights from that perspective. So the science will go on. It's just that we won't have a robotic asset actually visiting this destination in the next decade or so. That's not going to stop us from trying, though. We'll be pushing with every breath that we have to try and get a mission back to these exciting destinations.
Well, I'm sure you have your work cut out in planning those missions, be that to Saturn or elsewhere. There's a lot of work involved in those, I know. And, of course, the near future of those final phases of the Cassini mission and all the excitement there as well.
Yeah, it's going to be a very exciting few months as we see what the data has in store for us.
Well, we'll have to make sure to have a catch-up with you in September or after September this year to find out what Cassini's found in its final death throes, the final plunge into the atmosphere. So until then, Dr. Lee Fletcher from the University of Leicester, thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I don't know about you, Edward, but I'm really looking forward to the end of the... Well, I'm not looking forward to the mission ending, but this is going to be an exciting time.
Yeah, spectacular end, like the firework display at the end of a party, really. Yeah. It's going to be incredible to not only see that that magnificent body up close, but actually learn a huge amount of science on the descent as well.
So we'll bring you more on Cassini's final death plunge into Saturn over coming months. But until then, remember, you can get previous episodes at pythagastro.uk. Until next month, goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.